I don't know if you've ever been to a civil rights institute in America. Historically, we've had a lot of race tension, racial tension. And so in some places where we've had especially fierce battles over what it means to be just and civil to one another and for people to have civil rights, we've created memorials, civil rights institutes, and they're scattered throughout the South. I've been to one in Birmingham. They're eerie to walk through, very creepy, really, because as you're going around, there are all these statues and dioramas that you can sort of insert yourself into. You can walk in and watch police turning loose German shepherds on young black men, or sit on a segregated bus and hear audio recordings of a bus driver, you know, commanding people to sit on this side or that side, or walk into a segregated cafe where, you know, if you're of this ethnicity, you have to, you know, drink from this water fountain. If not, drink from this water fountain. And it's very creepy. Well, there was this man named Carl Purcell in Memphis. And Carl Purcell was just, you know, had a bit of free time, I guess. And so he went on a tour of the Civil Rights Institute there in Memphis. He was strolling around the museum when he saw a statue of a photographer. And the photographer was, I don't know, taking photos of Martin Luther King Jr. or somebody like that to symbolize the role of the press in advancing civil rights in America, bringing things to public light. Anyway, as he was looking at the statue, he noticed something. And I quote, "Suddenly, the hair literally stood up on the back of my neck. At first, I couldn't believe it, but then I realized it was true. I was confronting a younger, perhaps heavier, version of myself. It was like looking into a mirror and seeing myself 40 years ago. How a replica of me, as a young photographer, had found its way into the museum was almost beyond comprehension." So he began doing some investigation, and in fact, he was a photojournalist, and back in the days of some of the most dynamic civil rights displays and movements in America, he had been assigned to cover some really momentous events. And at one, he was falling right behind Martin Luther King Jr., taking his photograph, and evidently someone else took a photo of him taking a photo of Martin Luther King Jr. And that had made its way into an archive of civil rights memorabilia. And as a sculptor was looking through the photo album trying to find inspiration for his sculptures, he found this guy's photo and used him as a template for this statue. Now put yourself into Carl Purcell's shoes for just a minute. How weird would that be if you go to a museum and find a statue of yourself that you didn't even know existed? Wouldn't that kind of creep you out? That would be profoundly odd. At least he was a hero in that moment. I mean, what if he had gone in and found himself as a statue of one of the police officers releasing German shepherds? Or of someone beating someone else? And it just made me think that Carl Purcell had an experience in life that each of us is going to have in eternity. You see, the Bible teaches that someday we will all stand before God, specifically before God in the person of Jesus Christ. And at that moment, we're going to have sort of a recap of our lives. And in that instant, it will be just like Carl Purcell. We're going to see snapshots of what we have done. And we will either be vindicated or convicted as a result of what we see there. And so I want to ask you a question. What will the sculpture, the statue, the monument, the moment frozen forever in time of your life here at Stanford look like if it was going to kind of be boiled down into one image, one diorama? What would that look like? What would you have been doing differently, say, last night or last week, if you knew that it would be immortalized and would become a monument that endures, and someday you would look at it again? Tonight I want to throw out some possibilities to you for you to consider. The first, I will call the animal, the party animal. The person who lives for the now, and their complete value system is driven by pleasure and happiness. Their goal is simply to do as much as they can and have as much fun doing it as possible. They'll drink as much as they can, they'll smoke as many different substances as they can, and have as much sexual experience as possible. Now, their academic life may be fine, they compartmentalize a little bit, but their spiritual life, by any objective measure, is in total disarray, complete shambles. But they don't care, because they figure, if it's a matter of concern to them at all, they figure, I'll straighten it out once I graduate. Well, I'll straighten it out once I get a job. Well, I'll straighten it out once I get that promotion. Well, I'll straighten it out once I get married. Well, I'll straighten it out once I get kids. I'll straighten it out once I retire. I'll straighten it out once. But once never comes. It keeps on getting pushed back further and further and further. The Bible says, today is the day to make your decision. Today is the day for salvation. Today is the chance to set the trajectory for the rest of your life. Because if you wait till tomorrow, there's no guarantee that it's going to arrive. The future is always fuzzy. Even to the most astute prognosticators. Not too long ago in America, a whole bevy of experts were confidently predicting that Howard Dean would face George Bush in the presidential campaign. Well, he dropped out a while back. And now it looks almost certain that John Kerry's going to take it. But even then, we don't know for sure what's going to happen. My wife, a while back, we were very confident that her birth date would be sometime in early April. Now it looks like middle March is the most likely time for my daughter to enter the world. We never know what the future holds. The trajectory of your life is being calibrated right now, so be sure to pay attention to where the controls are being positioned. Maybe you've heard of something called the paradox of pleasure. When we pursue pleasure for its own sake, it becomes ephemeral, like mist in our grasp, and we can't hold on to it. There was a survey done of the 49 richest people in the world, as ranked by Forbes magazine, multi-billionaires. And you know what they found? That, on the whole, they were no happier than the rest of us. You take an index of any 49 people on Stanford's campus, and they'll probably be about as happy as the 49 richest people on the planet. What does that tell us? Whatever else we learn from that, happiness is not found in things or in the stuff you can buy with money. Happiness has got to derive from somewhere else. Louisiana-born poet Ogden Nash, I think, put it best. Ogden Nash is a hilarious poet. Love reading his stuff. There is only one way to achieve happiness on this terrestrial ball, and that's to have either a clear conscience or else to have none at all. So which one are you trying for here at Stanford? What will your sculpture, what will your snapshot look like? Another statue that I think we might see from several people at Stanford is this. The person with their nose buried in the book, the bookworm. The person whose God is their grades. They're driven by their GPA. Their whole life revolves around academics, and whenever they get a job, their whole life will revolve around their job. Whenever they get X, their life will revolve around X. Their reason for being becomes consumed by whatever is closest to them. They become nearsighted, like me. If I take my glasses off, I can tell there are people out there. But, you know, Johnny Joseph, I can't tell you apart now. I really lose my ability to see because I'm extremely nearsighted. And that's how many of us live our lives, with a focus on the immediate. In fact, I would say that in many ways, this is the twin cousin to the party animal. The statues, although they look very different, are driven by the same thing. Except the drug in this case is ambition. The drug in this case is achievement. The drug in this case is in some way proving ourselves, either to someone else, like our parents, or our peers, or maybe even to demonstrating to ourselves that we are who we think we are. And we didn't just get lucky on the standardized test or on whatever else assessment we're using to validate ourselves. I've said it many times in this context, and I'll say it again. An idol is anything that we look to derive our sense of security or our sense of significance from. And for most people at Stanford, I think it's pretty blatant that it's their academic performance, their own assessment of their intellect that determines their self-worth. And that's not a good place to live. If you don't get other-centric now, at this point in your life, you very likely never will. It's like generosity and charitable giving. If you're not generous now that you have hardly anything, you're kidding yourself if you think you're going to become a generous person when you have millions. It's not going to happen. The one who is faithful with little will not be faithful. The one who is unfaithful with little will not be faithful with much. And it's also true of our spiritual lives and our relational lives. If we can't look beyond the immediate hustle and bustle of campus now, while we're here in the midst of actually the relatively insignificant events of our quarter-to-quarter existence. I mean, really, 10 years from now, do you actually believe it'll make a difference whether you got an A or an A-minus on that test or that project? But then when we get a job, maybe we become a supervisor and someone else's livelihood depends on how well we equip them to do their job. it's going to become much more significant. And if we can't somehow become other-centric and bust beyond our immediate context right now, we won't be able to do it later in life, which is when many of us think we'll be able to. Again, just as with the party animal, this season of your life is a time to establish the habit of balance, especially spiritual balance. And the way that we do that is through what is called the classical spiritual disciplines or habits of the Christian life. Things like regular prayer, things like attending regular worship services, things like just doing nice things for people who can't do nice things back to you. Habits of holiness. Perhaps you've heard the story of the lumber cutting competition. It's relatively well known. This giant mountain of a man was paired off in the finals against a guy about my size. In fact, the guy was amazed, the big brute. How in the world did this little guy make it to the finals? They had an hour to cut as much lumber as possible. And so the referee starts and they go at it. And after about 10 minutes, the big guy notices out of the corner of his eye, the little guy just walks away. And he's like, ha-ha, little shrimp got tired already. I'm going to dog him. And then he comes back about a minute, 2 minutes later, and starts cutting again. And this cycle repeats. Every 5, 7, 10 minutes, the little guy leaves for a minute or two, and the big guy keeps going. The big guy, though, is starting to get very frustrated because even though he's working continuously and killing himself and giving it all he's got to the task at hand, this little guy, by the simple visual measure of amount of wood stacked up, is leaving him in the dust, is pulling way ahead. Finally, hour ends, time's up, and the big guy looks over, and the little guy has got twice as much lumber as he does. He's shocked. And he's not a good loser either. But eventually, once he's calmed down, he walks over and says, hey man, I'm bigger than you. I'm stronger than you. How in the world did you cut more lumber than I did? And where were you going every time you walked away? Me? I was just sharpening my axe. You've got to take time to sharpen your axe in life. You've got to connect at a spiritual level. Take a break from the immediate hurly-burly, hustle-bustle stuff that's going on around you. The rodeo of life, the 8 seconds of frenzy that never, ever ends. And connect with something beyond yourself. You've got to go and hang out with your friends. Even if you've got a great big project due. And if you don't give it everything you got, you might get a 99 instead of 100. Well, you know what? Go have some dessert with a friend. Get some coffee in the coho. Break out beyond yourself. And establish that habit in your life now. Because if you can't do it now, I promise you, you won't do it later. You have more discretionary time in your life right now than you're likely to have again until you retire. You don't believe me. But I promise you it is true. And if you don't believe it, ask a friend who recently graduated. Another statue that I think you might see summarizing a lot of people's lives here at Stanford would be something like this. For me? A very consumer-oriented person, very me-centric person. Stanford does a lot to reinforce this tendency in people. You're encouraged to shop for classes. Everything here seems to be, at times, to be handed to you on a silver platter. All these scholarships and research opportunities and this, that, and the other. And yes, you have to compete for them, but man, there's a lot more stuff given to you here than at a lot of other schools. And in fact, it amazes me every once in a while to read the Stanford Daily and to read the op-eds and letters to the editor there. Anytime that the university does anything to in any way not automatically give students like $1 billion, that seems to be the standard, people are howling as though they've had a dagger stuck into their side. It is just amazing the sense of entitlement sometimes that I find here among Stanford students. I would encourage you, don't be a consumer while you're here at Stanford. Be a contributor. Be a collaborator in the organizations you're involved with, in your relationships. Don't let it all be about you. In particular, I want to encourage you in this area spiritually. It is very, very easy to, for example, become a part of a group like this or to become part of a church where you attend on Sunday mornings and to assume that it's my responsibility, in this case, to take care of your spiritual health. Nothing could be further from the truth. Now, it's my job, given by God, to make it possible and as easy as possible for you to grow spiritually. I give you opportunities and I give you challenges. But in the final analysis, the responsibility for your own spiritual health and well-being can rest with no one else than you. On the final day, God's not going to ask me, why did so-and-so do so-and-so? God will ask me, Glenn, did you do the work that I gave you to do? Did you tell people what I told them in my word. Yes, God, I did. I hope I'll say. most times I did. I did my best. God's not going to ask me about you. God will go to you and say, tell me, why did you do this when Glenn Davis had clearly told you my opinion on the matter? Or why did you not do this when Glenn Davis had clearly told you my opinion on the matter? And then you'll have to give an answer to him. Now, of course, sometimes I'll be wrong. That's why in the final analysis, the only person who's responsible for your own spiritual health is you. But the consumer mentality that we breed here sometimes does not lead to that. And one of the markers, one of the true markers of spiritual health in a person, spiritual maturity, is recognizing that fact, that they're responsible for their own development. I want to talk very, very briefly, sort of a related note, but semi-tangential, about one of the worst spiritual habits that I see in students here at Stanford. They shop campus ministries the way that they shop classes at the beginning of the quarter, except there's no cutoff date. They just keep doing it and doing it and doing it. And I meet people all the time who are involved in three or four different campus ministries, they say. And what happens as a result to their spiritual life is that it's a mile wide and an inch deep. And basically, what happens in their life is that they go from ministry to ministry based on whoever's got the best worship at the time or the best teaching, or the best goosebumps, or the most dateable, you know, people, or whatever, you know, their criteria they're filtering through. And usually they look for the one that maximizes the most. And then as soon as one begins to wane in quality, either from a subjective perspective, or, you know, objectively most people are saying, yes, definitely, you know, the music's been off the last few weeks, or, you know, the last guy, you know, died, and the new person is just not as good as he was. You know, I don't know, whatever the vibe is. And they go on to another one. And often they're trying to get, you know, I'll get my primary teaching here and my worship experience here and this here and whatever different ingredients they feel go into making up their ideal spiritual mix. They blend them together like, you know, like some sort of crazy California bar or buffet. And as a result, they live life not on a growth curve, but on sort of a steady oscillation, like a sine wave. Never go too far up, never go too far down. And it's determined by their external circumstances because they've never learned the secret of taking their own responsibility for their spiritual growth, independent of how the ministry that they're a part of is doing. Because if you keep going to wherever the best teaching is, you never learn to teach yourself. If you keep going to where the best worship is, you never learn to stir yourself up in worship. By the mere act of commitment, by the simple act of resolving to plug in one place and to stay there, you affect the spiritual trajectory of your whole life. Merely by that act. Now, there's more to it than that. You've got to do more than just commit. It's like a marriage. Commitment's a non-negotiable part of the whole mix. But if commitment's all you got, you don't have much. But without commitment, you don't have anything at all. It's a precondition, but not a sufficient condition. Necessary, but not sufficient. Another thing that I see, or another angle on this to understand the problem with the hyper-multiple involvement. What I'm not saying, by the way, I'm not saying it's wrong to go do something. There's a special speaker somewhere, or a special event you want to be a part of. That's great. Unity in the body of Christ is a wonderful thing. I strongly encourage that. But people who are involved in 2, 3, 4 worship services during the week are telling me they don't understand what it's about. If you go to a ministry just for what you can get, you're on the road to being a spiritual glutton. If you go to a ministry just for what you can give, you're on the road to being a spiritual martyr. But if you go to a ministry primarily because of what you can accomplish together, you're on the road to spiritual health. It's a principle of focus. Ants can walk around on a sidewalk all day long in the hot sun. But if you bust out the magnifying glass, they best scurry for their lives. Focus matters. Focus matters. So I spent a lot of time on that one, but it's because I feel very strongly about it. Having a consumeristic mentality towards the spiritual and the relational side of life will mess you up worse than anything else that I can think of. The final sculpture that I want to hold out to you today is the prophet. The person who's got a Bible in one hand and a newspaper in another, who's got a bridge between the world and the Word. Here at Stanford, maybe it's having a textbook in one hand and a Bible in the other. It's the person who spends time in prayer and then also does problem sets to the glory of God. The person who works really hard to get good grades because they believe that it's a reflection of their spiritual health, how well they do the tasks that God has given them to do, but who also is always looking out for needs in the lives of their friends and even their rivals to see if they can meet those needs and be a blessing to them on Christ's behalf. It's the person who is always ready to talk about, you know, calculus or physics or international relations or whatever your major may be. But then is also equally ready to talk about The Passion of the Christ, the movie by Mel Gibson, or to talk about why someone might believe in God, or to talk about what to do when you've been deeply betrayed by someone that you trusted. It's the person who acts as Christ ambassador, Christ representative. That's what a prophet is. A prophet is someone who acts as a bridge between God and man, and between God's words and man's world. It's very, very possible for this to be the statue that commemorates your time here at Stanford. See, that's the wonderful thing about all these options I laid out before you, and there's so many others, so many different ways we could live our lives. Each of us gets to choose. We're our own sculptor. We get to pick what monument, what moment frozen forever in time will we leave behind us. And so tonight, my simple question is, what will you choose? What will you choose? You don't have a choice about being commemorated any more than Carl Purcell did. He was there to take pictures of others. He never thought he'd be part of the story. But someone took a picture of him. And just as I believe it's painfully obvious to anybody walking through the Civil Rights Institute, who made the right choices in those difficult times? I mean, can you imagine being the guy walking along and seeing yourself beating somebody? Or seeing yourself doing any, you know, fill in the blank, any reprehensible thing? Do you really think that person's standing there saying, "Yeah, I'm proud of that"? I don't think so. Have you ever talked to a war vet? Most of them are not real happy about the things that they did, even if they're convinced ultimately that war is justifiable and that they were in a just war. Just as it's obvious to anybody walking through that institute who was right and who was wrong, on that final day, when we get our own diorama constructed by God, when we're in our own sculpture garden of life, and Jesus is walking through us with it, let's talk about this right here. What were you thinking? What were you doing? Why did you choose that? No, I know why you really chose it. Level with me. Let's talk about this over here. You're not going to be standing there saying, no, it's all good. Hey, it's all good. No, just like the guy walking through the Civil Rights Institute, I strongly suspect you just won't want to talk about it anymore at all. You can't wait for the tour to be over. And so who will you be? Join me in prayer. Father, I thank you that we have the privilege of charting our own course in life. It's a responsibility, both wonderful and terrible. Help us to be who you made us to be. Help us to fulfill our destiny and our potential. Help us to be your sons and your daughters, representatives of you to a hurting and needy world. God, I pray that we won't have to weep on the day that we see the statue of our lives, the statue that commemorates our time here at Stanford, the statue that commemorates how we're going to act over spring break, the statue that commemorates all the different moments that make up a lifetime, the 86,400 seconds that go into every day, 86,400 statues that we're going to look at with you. God, we're sorry for some of the ugly sculptures we've made. We just ask for your forgiveness, and we ask for your grace in our lives. And we ask you to help us do better in the future. Destroy the old God. Just knock it to rubble. And help us to erect, with your help, a glorious and magnificent statue that looks like Jesus in its place. We ask this in his name. And everyone said, Amen.